Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference Podcast. This podcast features a conference session by Cynthia Teniente Mattson, Vice President for Administration and Chief Financial Officer at California State University, Fresno. Her session is entitled Oil Spills, Volcanoes, and Higher Education, Leading in Strange Times.
I hope you will think about the fact that as leaders in this industry, in this profession, there is so much uncertainty in the future. The one thing that we know for sure, what got us here in the past isn't going to work in the future. So it's really challenging all of our frames of thinking and all of our references. We're living through a period of tumultuous change and economic uncertainty. We all know that. The current economy is showing no signs of improvement. It's a very sluggish response. It has spared absolutely no industry, including our own. As a global economy, we continue to face monumental changes and have focused industries, world economies, and all of us here today to reframe our thinking. Let go of traditional thinking, focus on innovation, and focus on what's going to take us forward. Yet we continue to experience many unplanned major events that are so unconventional, like these examples we're going to talk about. It's tested and challenged all facets of our business, and I know this is happening at your campus as well. I began thinking how these global impacts have impacted my thinking, and that's what I'm going to share with you today, how I viewed the challenges and the uncertainty facing higher education. So it's forced me to put a wide-angle, multi-spectrum lens on my thinking. And I'm going to ask you to do the same as we go through the morning. I'm going to ask you to put those lenses on and apply it to the current state of a higher education business environment. So we're going to look at this metaphor for leadership and change, that is these business interruptions, these disasters going on in the world. In every sector of the market, we see this. So let's talk about some leadership lessons and how they apply to higher education, technology, and our role as business officers in universities. I'm going to start by describing this fundamental construct that I found helpful in thinking about this, and I call this jolts to the system. So the premise of this multi-spectrum lens that we're going to be talking about is focused on leadership and change, and what activity has caused the leadership change to the reaction. This is what I refer to when I say jolts to the system. All industries have been undergoing that. So let's take a look at the word jolt. And I want you to focus on the part that says interrupt disturbingly. That seems to be happening all over our campuses and all over the world. But when I refer to jolts, I want you to think about cataclysmic proportions. These are not minor changes. These are major disruptions, major jolts. We're going to start by first exploring the effects of the Icelandic volcano that erupted on April 14th, right before tax day. The first time in almost two centuries, that's 200 years. There was a whole reaction about the danger to planes from the volcanic ash plume that led most northern European countries to close airspace between April 15th and April 20th, grounding about 10 million travelers worldwide. So what do you think are the impacts on leadership from a technology and business officer perspective? This was definitely a cataclysmic event, but one that had to be responded to and reacted to. It was a major jolt to the industry, their operational systems, and its stakeholders. So there's several leadership lessons that come to mind for me. And I encourage you to think about what comes to mind for you. There was an overwhelming pent-up demand and tension in the system that was surrounded by the plume of volcanic ash, the unknown. To me, this is very parallel to our uncertainty around our state budgets and our state situations. We have absolutely no control over what's happening, but there is an enormous pent-up demand and tension waiting and waiting and waiting for something that no one can answer, much like what was happening in this situation. Now, the journalist referred to dependency on the synchronized movement of interlocking parts, and I quoted that up here. And as I thought about that, and I watched this over and over and over again, and I thought to myself, you know, that's very parallel from my perspective to our registration and instructional systems, where we've grown interdependent on the technology. So we're using that technology for administering and teaching all of our courses, for administering all everything that's going on in the university. So what happens when we have a technology outage that has public failure, and everyone knows it? So this can happen in the classroom on a much smaller scale. It could happen institution-wide at a very broader scale, and it could happen in a session like today. So the reaction for each of those situations is obviously different depending on how large the impact of the disruption is. There were large degrees of frustration, cynicism, and disappointment to the whole jolt in the system. Does this sound like something that your students might be experiencing or go through, or that your employees might experience or go through? People don't care what's happening. They don't care why it's happening. They just know they have limited choices and little information. They care about their own personal situation, just like we do at our campuses. It doesn't matter that it was enormously complex. What matters is how it felt to that individual customer at the end. So let's talk a little bit about what chief business officers might have been thinking about. Do you think their business continuity plan worked? Do you think they had a business continuity plan for a situation of this magnitude? What about resource allocation? They said it was going to take 96 hours to get all the interlocking parts and pieces back together, moving everything around. What do you think their resource allocation decisions were at that moment when they were so constrained? Just like our resource allocation decisions, we have to make decisions about what money we have, what people we have, what talent we have, what technology we have, what other external resources we can bring in to help the situation, third-party vendors, all of those things. Do you think that was happening there in that airport, in that airline industry? I'm sure it was. And what about risk management and safety? Now, beyond the traditional security methods that we might be thinking about, as it turns out, there's a lot of questions about whether a plane can actually fly during this type of volcanic ash and which direction the wind is moving and all these other things that impact whether the aircraft engine can actually handle it. So there was a lot of debate going on in the back rooms about when and how many planes could take off. And so you saw there also some discussion about relaxing government regulations. Does that ever happen in our industry? Relaxing government regulations to help us solve a crisis or a problem? Maybe in some rare instances, but mainly not. So they were really challenged by this cataclysmic event to get all those people moving, get all the planes in the right place, get all the crews together, just like we at times in our campus are struggling with all these issues. This particular six-day period impacted 10 million travelers, and it had an impact of approximately 1.5 billion euros. That is greater than the impact that they saw in 9/11, and they referred to that. And incidentally, over the last few days when I was doing some research about this particular industry, I learned that there was a group that came together looking at understanding, studying how that volcanic ash moves, understanding how the volcanic ash would impact their aircraft and their engines, and streamlining the roles of those that would be affected by future interruptions. And their focus was to universally understand who's doing what. Just that statement, who's doing what, can only lead you to imagine what happened there in that situation, just like what's happening on our campuses sometimes. We have all kinds of chaos going on occasion, not always, and we wonder, sometimes scratch our head, who is doing what? On the subject of safety, there was another major issue that came up there after the fact, and that is that airlines wanted more responsibility for determining when flights would operate. Does that sound like anything we would do at our campus? We want more responsibility determining what we're going to do in our campuses. We don't want necessarily a lot of guidance from the federal government, although we're getting a lot of it now. We don't necessarily want a lot of guidance from our system offices. We think we know what needs to be done, and we want to be able to do that. And it was interesting to me to see that parallel. Okay, let's move on to a man-made disaster. So put your leadership hat on and put your multi-spectrum lens on, and let's watch about maybe it's a minute and a half of this video clip. And the focus is on leadership. Again, thanks to CBS.
Operation to plug the leaking oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. Engineers stopped the process Thursday when they realized the heavy fluid they were pumping onto the leak was spilling along with the plumes of crude oil. Meanwhile, President Obama is insisting the federal government and not BP is calling the shots in cleaning up what is now the worst oil spill in U.S. history.
I take responsibility. It is my job to make sure that everything is done to shut this down.
And joining us now with more on Washington's response to the spill is David Marks, senior editor for Politico. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. We just heard the president taking full responsibility. Was that the right course of action for him?
It's a good start for the president, but a lot of people still want to see some real passion on the part of President Obama. He's going down to the Gulf of Mexico area, to the Louisiana coast, but they want to see him get angry about this and really look like the federal government is almost taking over the rescue effort. So far, that has not really happened.
What role can the federal government play in this, given that so many people are saying that BP is the only entity with the kind of expertise needed to handle the situation?
Right. The president was pretty open about that in his press conference on Thursday, saying that the federal government really only has limited powers. Also, under federal law, after the Exxon Valdez disaster up in Alaska, it's really private industry who are on the hook for cleaning up oil messes like this. So there is a limited amount that the federal government can actually do, but I still think people want to see the president get angry, passionate, and really kind of stirred up and fired up about this terrible ecological disaster.
So what's happening here? We see the commander-in-chief taking full responsibility for this action. Just like happens on our college campuses, we see college presidents or vice presidents taking full responsibility for things that are happening in our campus, particularly when they hit the national press. So what do we hear from the newscaster? It didn't seem like enough. It didn't seem like it was passionate enough. Our commander-in-chief was saying all the right things. Now, it's an oversimplification to say that this situation is enormously complex. Just like things like that that happen in our campus when we have a disruption of technology or disruption to our business practices. There's rarely a simple answer or a simple solution. Oftentimes, third-party vendors can be involved. And we have agreements with those third-party vendors for uninterrupted service or whatever that case may be. Yet, when we have a problem, it's us in this room that are responsible, not the third-party vendor. So you heard the Politico analyst talking about the fact that the federal government really wasn't responsible for making sure the cleanup took place. It was really a third party. So you might be saying the right words, but it doesn't come across as authentic. Do people perceive you to be authentic on your college campus? Do you have the kind of trust, credibility, and authentic political capital to be effective in times of uncertainty or change? Because that's what we're in right now, significant times of uncertainty and change. Can your message carry the day? If you're saying the right thing, is it going to carry the day? Are you clearly communicating with integrity and consistency? This is a major critical issue as people around our campuses are so filled with uncertainty. They need as much predictability as you can provide, not only with information, but with confidence. In these times of rapid change, we need confidence in our leaders. We have to act with confidence. Now, irrespective of the political party, as I mentioned earlier, there seems to be general consensus among the American public that President Obama is a great orator. Yet in this situation, we watched it. It didn't carry the day. And we all know that our actions have to match our words. Somehow, some way, there's a lot coming at you, more than you can actually get done in a day, particularly this time of the year, October, middle of the semester, everything's in full flux. You have to find a way to get out of what I call the vortex. And I use this phrase often with my management team. And we sometimes manage to forget things like that, that we're in the vortex. We can only see things through our perspective. And so when you come to these kinds of conferences, part of what you're supposed to be doing is rejuvenating and reflecting and reaffirming what's important now. Let me tell you, no matter what's going on in the world, leadership and integrity are still the most valuable assets and important character traits that we as business officers or technology officers need. And we can't lose sight of that, no matter what your position is in the organization. And I think that's the most critical thing I want you to take away from watching our commander-in-chief take a look at what's going on in the world. And I have to tell you, I always find it challenging on my campus whenever we have any kind of a technology issue, or any other issues, actually, it doesn't just happen in technology, when there's a third party involved. And I always get this, well, the vendor's supposed to, or the contract with the vendor says. And how do you hold these third-party vendors accountable? How do you manage that interrelationship and interconnection? Especially in these times, everyone's cutting corners. All of us have contracts, yet things still don't seem to be going the way we plan in all facets. It's not just technology. This is in facilities. It's in procurement. It's in public safety. It's happening everywhere. The reliability of our third-party vendors is not as strong as it used to be. And that doesn't mean that our third-party vendors aren't strategic partners and all of those things. I don't mean that at all. What I mean is that in these periods of uncertainty, when you're relying on some outside firm to help you deliver a quality and core service on your campus, how are you going to manage that vendor and manage for accountability? And we have forgotten some of those techniques. And for that sort of shame on us in terms of waiting until it's too late in some cases or not having enough systems in place to recognize when we have problems until we get to the point of failure. Now let's turn to higher education. Thank goodness I wouldn't say we have a disaster amongst us, but I would say we have a period of great uncertainty, as we've been talking about this morning, as I'm sure you've heard through the conference and from other speakers. What we do as an industry today is going to impact the future of the United States and really our global economy for the next 100 years. So let's talk a little bit about some data and statistics. So as I've mentioned earlier, we have a slow-moving recovery. Some people call this a jobless recovery. We have unemployment rates hovering around 9.5% to 9.7%. Different parts of the country have much higher rates, stemming up into 12, 13, 14%. So you can see how this breaks down. What we see from this chart is that a bachelor's degree or higher, so the last two columns or last two rows, those individuals with those degree credentials have provided some insular protection in this economy. You see there that the bachelor's degree or higher in May 2009 was 4.8, May 2010, 4.7, as compared to high school graduates going in May 2009 to May 2010. So in the reverse, those areas are hit the hardest. And they also have the greatest risk of being left behind. Now, President Obama's attainment goals for 2020. His goal is that we will become the most educated workforce in the world. So let's take a look at what that means. By 2018, the economy is going to create approximately 46.8 million openings. That's 13.8 million brand new jobs and 33 million replacement jobs. Those are positions vacated by workers who've either retired or permanently left their occupations. Nearly two-thirds of these 46.8 million jobs, some 63%, will require workers with at least some college education. So you've got an external demand focusing more need and attention to education. We know that. This is not new to us. Nowadays, about 60% of Americans go on to some kind of education or formal training after high school. Over the past several decades, about 70% of the increase in the requirements for post-secondary has stemmed from some upgrades in skills demanded by categories that didn't previously need higher education. In 1973, there were 25 million jobs that required applicants with at least some college education. And that's what this graph shows. By 2007, that number had nearly quadrupled to 91 million jobs. Since the early 70s, the American economy has transformed from one that featured more jobs for high school diplomas than for college graduates, to one that we see now when the share of jobs for dropouts has plunged from roughly one-third to 11%. In 1973, only 28% of the workers had any post-secondary education. By 2007, that number climbed to 59%. In fact, the share of workers with an associate's degree, college degree, or some college has more than doubled from 12% to 27% of the workforce. Bachelor's degrees also has more than doubled from 9% in 1973 to 21% in 2007. Graduate degrees have increased in a slightly slower pace, going from 7% to 11% over the same period. So what we see is this trend is only going to continue. By 2018, more than 63% of our prime-aged workers will need some type of post-secondary instruction. The proportion of workers who need at least an associate's degree, a certificate, or some other sort of college will increase from 27% in 2007 to 29% in 2018. And the share of workers who must have a bachelor's degree will climb from 21% to 23%. And we know this to be true just from being in the workforce and working in higher ed, but it's really interesting to have the numbers before you. Now, this data comes from the Center of Education and Workforce at Georgetown. If you want to go in and download the full report, they have a very extensive analysis of the projections of jobs and education requirements through 2018. Let's talk a little bit more about that. By 2018, the post-secondary system will have produced 3 million fewer college graduates than demanded by the labor market. According to their research and assumption, we end up with the shortfall of workers with associate's degrees moving over to bachelor's degrees. At our current rate, degrees conferred would have to increase by about 10% a year to eliminate the shortfall. Or, on the reverse, the economy has to slow its demand for higher education in its workers. As we can see, that's probably not going to happen. I chose purposely today not to talk about for-profit universities, but I do want to say one thing about this. We have a shortfall. We will have a shortage in supply. There continues to be a place and a role for for-profits in higher education and alternative means. Now, whatever your perspective is on the problems that they're having right now as an industry and the struggles they're going through, with gainful employment rules and some of their other scandals that have been hitting the public press lately. One thing is for certain. We need someone to fill that need if it's not going to be the people in this room filling that need. So there continues to be a demand for the for-profits. And my prediction, if I were to make one, is the for-profits are going to figure out the problems they have right now, and they're going to come out of this. Will they be as strong? Maybe, maybe not. Will they have the same level of profits? Maybe, maybe not. Will they continue to be a competitor with us? Probably so. Now, I'm told, although I haven't seen the data, that there are attitudinal surveys that would suggest employers, people in the workforce, find many of these universities to be credible, to have quality graduates. So we can't necessarily hold on to that we have this great prestigious degree that others can't achieve or meet, because the industry is telling us that may or may not be true. Now, like I said, I haven't seen the data on that, but I've been told. So we need to be aware of the market constraints going on around us. Now, another factor, student demographics in the U.S. are changing. So if you followed President Barack Obama's national goals, he's aimed at boosting high school and college graduation rates. So this figure shows public high school graduates by race and ethnicity from 2001 and what's projected to 2022. You can even think that far. The 2020 goal, as Secretary Arne Nixon refers to, is that roughly 60% of current Americans will have to earn college degrees and certificates by 2020 to regain our international lead. This is compared to about 40% that we have now. How does this feel like a jolt to our system? Does this feel like a man-made disaster or a natural disaster? I don't know. The jury's still out for me on that, but it's certainly something for you to think about in your markets and your community. So let's look at these numbers a bit. When you combine a student population increasingly of groups that have traditionally been less comfortable with college, and a higher ed system that is increasingly underfunded for its current basic mission, and a national push for graduating more students, this certainly feels like the makings of a disaster to me. The bottom line is the Hispanic population, the 161,093. And we see that growing, and that was the number of high school graduates in 2008-09, according to WICHE, from a public report called Knocking at the College Door, which you can also find by looking at the WICHE website. And you can actually find this data broken down by region. So I know this is a national conference, and I just pulled national numbers. But they have it broken down by West, South, Eastern, and Midwest. Okay, so the Hispanic numbers, I just went over from 161 to 244, 143. The next line above that is African American. We have 480,187 graduates reported in 2008. The next dark line is the African American students. The line above that is Asian American students at the 480,187 to the 780,268. And the top line is traditional Caucasian students. This is where the number of students that need to come into our universities are going to come from. And what you can see, it's not among the affluent white young people who are already likely to attend college, particularly our four-year colleges, and graduate in even more numbers disproportionate to the rest of the population. So there's a greater number of young people coming from historically disadvantaged groups who we have to prepare to enter and succeed in post-secondary education. Secondarily, we're going to have to look at meeting the even more daunting challenge of helping those who have missed out on college find a way back in. Remember those high school dropout numbers we were looking at earlier, or those who just had high school that were going into college? Perhaps the most interesting and telling thing for us is that it's not going to be business as usual. At least it shouldn't be at your universities. If we're going to meet the goals that the Obama administration has set for us, and if we're going to face the facts of who's coming into our front door in the next 20 years, what we're doing today is not necessarily going to serve that population in the future. These populations that we have to focus on are exactly those that have the least amount of money to pay. They can least afford to get in, and at least for now, they're still very strapped for funds. This is going to force us to rethink seriously how we deliver instruction. And I know you're all talking about that on your campuses right now, but you have to be the most innovative that you can be, providing visionary and strategic leadership on your campus, because this is creeping up on us at a faster pace than we can keep up with, at the same time that we have declining resources. So your innovation is critical as a chief technology officer or an academic technology professional, that is critical to people like me, to chief business officers, to vice presidents, and to presidents. This is a critical conversation that we're having on our campus, and I'm sure it's a critical conversation that you're having on yours. Our old models, particularly our old business models, will not sustain what we need. They won't sustain what we need today. They won't sustain what we need in the future. Now, this figure is taking a little bit of a look at the economy, and it's just one slide. And this is also from the Center on Education and the Workforce forecast on the educational demand through 2018. Many economists predict that we're going to see months of jobless recovery, such as that we experienced in 1990 and 2001. What that means is that our economic output will grow, but it's not going to immediately generate job growth. Instead of hiring new workers, employers will ask existing employees to work longer hours to meet rising demand. Does that sound like anything happening at your campus? Probably not, huh? We project more job losses for 2010 that are going to total about 300,000, and they do not see any net gains resuming until 2011. So to reach the employment levels we would have reached without a downturn, the economy would need to create a net total of 11 million jobs, 2.6 million new jobs for people who have been entering the labor market since the recession began, adding to the 7.8 million existing jobs that were already lost. So in other words, the economy is not going to get back on track, not anytime soon, and by this indication, not until 2015, even with this addition to job creation flows. So for many, a full recovery is going to actually be a hollow accomplishment. Hundreds and thousands of low-skilled jobs in manufacturing, farming, fishing, forestry, those types of skilled areas have been permanently destroyed because the recession has forced those industries to use technology to automate those positions or ship them overseas for cheap labor. Overall, according to this forecast, they project an additional 637,000 jobs in manufacturing and the natural resources industry will be obsolete by 2018. And the jobs that replace them will be very different jobs requiring very different kinds of workers and very different kinds of preparation in college setting. Now let's look at this IRL in real life. What are others saying about higher education? I'm going to have you look at this video clip that is talking about, believe it or not, whether a college degree is worth it. So keep that in mind as you go back to your campus and you look at what's happening there and know how people are being influenced and what that means to you and your workplace. If you think it's a good idea that students are being told that they should take a year off and go be a pastry chef because that's such a cheap option, think about some of those impacts and reflections on the advice people are getting from non-university professionals. Now, does that mean we're doing everything right? Probably not. They're filling a gap because our message is a difficult one. We have to get better at this. And that's the point I want to leave you with, is we've been looking at the various elements that impact higher education. We looked at demography. We looked at some of the economic impacts. We looked at the type of people that are going to be coming in. You have to look at what people are saying about us outside of our industry. And that's what people are saying about us. Agree or disagree. Okay, I'm going to run out of time here, so there's a couple of things I want you to think about. What are your organizational jolts at your campus? I made a list here of things that you might want to think about. You know, governance. Does governance need an organizational jolt? What are our organizational dynamics? What are the financial resources? What are our human resources looking like? What's our strategy for engaging employees? We have these enormous pressures to be more effective and more efficient in all areas of our technology resources. This is what's the cover of major news magazines. How do you manage change? How do you get the best from people? Those types of things. So what higher education needs now is leadership. And that's why you're all here. Here's my advice to you. There are an enormous number of changing cultural and changing expectations. Our industry alone cannot survive in its current state for the next 500 years, maybe not even the next 25 years. So we have a changing culture. We have changing expectations both externally and internally, a lot more influence from the federal government about what's happening in our industry. We need every position to be technology savvy. I don't mean just IT. I mean every position. Your financial experts, your HR experts, your facilities experts, everyone's technology skills have to ramp up We have to be more savvy to respond to the future. We have to be innovative. We have to be able to lead during uncertain times. We have to be able to deal with ambiguity. We have to be dynamic communicators. And in every one of these circles, I have the word integrity. And the integrity, as I mentioned at the start of the talk, is something that you cannot go forward without. We must have integrity in everything we do. As we change cultures and change expectations, we cannot shortcut out means that protect integrity. You cannot shortcut your integrity. This is important because when things are moving fast and people are looking for quick solutions, we sometimes forget and do things we wouldn't normally do. And I'm not talking about fraudulent activities. I'm talking about saying it's okay to do it just this one time. It's okay to do it just this one or two times. You can never compromise integrity in our organization, in our systems, in our security, in our processes, and everything else. So three things I want you to remember. Uncertainty is going to be with us for a while. Everything around us is changing. You will have to be leaders in this next generation of change. And the collaboration is going to be key. So who is your chief collaboration officer? Recognize and plan for jolts to your system and be prepared to deal with them. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. I hope you enjoyed this.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.